Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with novelist, editor, and educator Elizabeth Sims. Elizabeth's story is particularly interesting because although she discovered her passion for, interest in, and capacity for working with words and stories, it took her a long time to get around to saying, "This is who I am, and this is what I do." It's really instructive. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Is about being the person you really are. Not some version of yourself, but the person you really are. As a therapist, I have seen many too many people in denial for things that they actually have and living lives that are versions of, but not the complete truth about who they are. For my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the interview I'm airing today with Elizabeth Sims is a wonderful example of a woman who took time to accept who she really was, having discovered her attachment to words and stories early in life. It took her a while to embrace. So Elizabeth tells this story better than I can. So here now is novelist, educator, editor, Elizabeth Sims. So I'm here with Elizabeth Sims, who is a writer and also an editor and a teacher of writing, right?
Yes, you can say that too.
Well,
yes.
She wrote this book. You've got a book in you, A Stress-Free Guide to Writing the Book of Your Dreams. So clearly you have some teaching in you.
Yes, I do. And in fact, I'm just beginning to teach at the Ringling College of Art and Design here in Sarasota, nearby Sarasota. teaching some creative writing to the students there.
Really?
So yeah, I'll be starting this fall term just as an adjunct, one class right now, and I'm looking forward to it. It should be interesting.
Lovely. Would this be part of? It's part of the school. It's not part of the film department or part of the animating department. It's just part, right?
They have a liberal arts, you know, department, and they have a creative writing program that is fairly new, and the boss of that program approached me a few months back saying, "What kind of degrees do you have?" I said, "I know where this is going." So we talked about it, and he said, "Yeah, I think you'd be great teaching a short story workshop." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I'd give it a try." So
that's fascinating. That I didn't know that they had a creative writing department. I wonder if the film student, can everybody take it, or just people who are taking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. It can be. I think there's a lot of electives, you know, all over the place that students can take. I know that school is mostly known for the film and art and design and so forth. So this, like I say, this is fairly new, but I don't know how new exactly the writing program. But it fits in with what.
Yes.
With what the college is supposed to be about.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, it seems to me, the art to which you have given your life and are making your living is the art of writing.
Yes.
Good. Okay, good. So I only have one question, and it is, can you remember, can you tell me the very first time in your life that you were drawn to story fiction, making up stuff, writing? You're shaking your head, so I assume that yes.
Oh, yeah, all of... all of us, I think, start out as readers or listeners, consumers of stories before we become manufacturers of stories, is one way to put it. When I was a tiny child, I was attracted to books and stories. My beloved dad would set me on his knee and tell me stories that he would make up when I was very small. And I
very small, three,
oh,
five?
Sitting on knee size, I guess, you know, three or four or five,
mm-hmm.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And so I loved those stories that he would make up. And oddly enough, so many of them had to do with a little girl who lost her dolly. And that little girl just looked all over for her dolly. But what do you know, but that little dolly was right in that little girl's backyard the whole time. Or it was the alley. It was back in the alley the whole time. And he'd tell Sinbad the Sailor stories and stories of his own childhood about getting in trouble for not bringing the cows back in time, things like that. I don't even know if they had a cow, but that was the story. Anyway, one really develops a love of story, first, and then...
Well, wait, I just want to say that...
Yeah.
Obviously, you still remember that.
Yes.
So clearly, very compelling to you. I think not everybody would have made the leap, but clearly for you, the idea of story and making it up on the fly, right? He wasn't reading anything.
He did read some to me, but he did make up.
Yes. So he did. He gave you right then and there the idea that one could make up a story.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I mean, of course, to me, it was all gospel, and, you know, he didn't make up anything. It was all true, you know, but
yes.
Yes, you understand. Yeah, you understand, exactly.
I do, and also that it was coming from somebody that you loved so much.
Yes, and trusted.
And trusted, exactly, so, exactly.
Then probably the next big thing in my life, and I remember my mother sitting and reading to me as well. We had some...
So everybody was reading, everybody...
The library was a big thing. Yes. And getting an education was a big thing. I am technically a first-generation American. My father was born in Poland and came over when he was a boy with his family. And my mother's people were also Polish, and her parents came over, and she was born in this country. Some of her brothers, I think, were born back in the old country. At any rate, so assimilation and learning the language and getting, you know, doing well in school were important, as typical of many immigrants. So that happened. Well, the other key thing in my development was when I was 6 years old, entering the first grade, my mother decided, who had been a stay-at-home mom and part-time peace worker doing dress and drapery manufacturer, she decided that she would go to college and become a teacher. She wanted to be a high school teacher of English. How she decided on that at first, I don't know, but I know she wasn't very good at math, and so there you go, I guess. And she wanted to bring the family up a little bit. I think my father was a machinist. He worked in a factory, and he was proud of his work, and we were all proud of him, but with three kids, his pay wasn't going to stretch all that far, I think, and I think she was thinking that. So she had ambitions for herself. So when I started first grade, she started going to the teacher college in Michigan, where we were from, Eastern Michigan. And what happened, the upshot of that was, for me, I didn't have mommy at home as much, but I didn't really care. I mean, I was practically grown up at 6 years old, I felt, you know, handle myself, you know, in the neighborhood and everything. But she brought home books. She brought home more and more books all the time. She brought home books that were too old for me to read, but she did bring home some children's literature books, and I wanted to read everything, and she would leave around papers or a copy of a poem or something, and I'd pick these things up and read them. I would pick up books that were, you know, for older, you know, I mean, older people. Like, I was an early reader, I guess, or, you know, a fairly good reader, I think.
Wait. You were clearly an early reader. Do you remember how you learned to read? You don't learn to read in kindergarten.
No, not in those days anyway. We learned our ABCs, I guess, you know, but... and I remember reading the little books in first grade with, you know, the cat sat on the mat, and learning words then. And so, I don't know, I guess I just kind of came to me fairly easily.
Apparently it came to you very easily. And not only did it come to you very easily, but it came to you with a kind of passion. I really love this, and I want to get at this every minute I can. That's what it's sounding like. Is that wrong?
No, you're right. You're right, Lynn. And the thing was, even though my mom tried to protect me, so I was then from 6 years old to 10 years old while she was going full-time to school, so I was growing up and getting up to be a better reader. The other part of it, along with being able to read all this stuff, among them, an anthology of children's literature from all around the world that was a standard in teaching colleges at that time. And I mean, I could sit there with that huge thing on my lap and I could just keep reading and reading. It's so big and thick, and it had so much in it, and I could read about these little kids in, you know, in Sweden, you know, and I could read about the bad witch that lived in the German forest, and, you know, and all this stuff. That was just a tremendous thing for me. But the other thing that she instilled in me was this tremendous reverence for books and for authors, for those who wrote them. And basically the message was, well, there's hardly any achievement in the whole world more fabulous than writing a book, you know, writing things for people to read, or poetry, you know, stories and poems. And so I absorbed that, you know. And
obviously. Right. Yeah. I mean, really, I don't know if confluence is the right word. I'm going to use it, and you'll tell me if it is. The confluence of your clearly being drawn to and fascinated by and obsessed really with reading, and your mother extolling the virtues of those who write. I mean, really, what could you have become?
Well, actually, for a long time, I wish I had been born a boy and I would go into the army or the police. I was very interested in those things, but that was not to be. And I was just, you know,
well, actually, now you could have. Actually.
Yes. But it would much easier these
days. Yeah. Well, wait. But your character, your heroine, she does. She's a detective, essentially.
Oh, yes, right. Yes, both of my main female characters, yes, in the two different little series that I write. So I was going to say, it seemed almost, you know, in a way inevitable, although, you know, I kind of cast around doing various things, but I kind of was always around writing and creativity and so forth. But, you know, one must also make a living, and one must also find one's way.
Wait. I want to go to the find one's way thing. Mm-hmm. So I here we have you at 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, mm-hmm. Creating the foundation of what would finally be your life's work. So, but then you're only in, elementary school, middle school, so what happens?
Yeah, well, you know, you keep reading on your own time, but you have to learn your subjects in school, and your math and your history, and then high school, your chemistry and so forth, and things like that, which I did. And I kind of was somewhat good at science as well, so some people thought, well, she'll be a science person. Excuse me, I had a little friend who shared with me at age 10 the recipe for gunpowder. He had learned what that recipe was, and I said, well, that's really cool. I have a chemistry set. Can we make it in my chemistry set? And he said, well, we need the carbon black, and that's fine. Well, I got that, yeah. Sulfur, I got that, yeah, but we need potassium nitrate. Well, where do we get that? Well, the guy in the drugstore will sell you some. You know, and I go, well, really? So we made gunpowder, and we had a lot of fun with that. It's kind of amazing that I emerged from childhood with all my fingers and toes and eyesight and hearing intact, but yeah, that, and part of being young and wanting to, or having the urge to create on the page, especially, well, you know, you don't have a lot of life experience yet at that point, and sometimes you don't have all that much to say. You need to get a little more under your belt, both experience living and experience writing and reading more and so forth. So there are some phenoms who, you know, burst out of high school with some, you know, Pulitzer winning something or other. They're certainly the outliers, and most of us have to move along. And a lot of kids who go to college and decide that they want to get a MFA in writing and, you know, get some things published, well, you know, they kind of force themselves through these programs, and sometimes they're really not all that ready, and whatever they produce isn't necessarily all that great yet, you know, mm-hmm. and you just kind of need some maturity. So that, and I was definitely like that. I was very leery of getting instruction in creative writing. I didn't want to take anything. I took a course in creative writing in high school, one course, short story writing, and forgive me if I doubt that she will ever hear this, but if you're a listening teacher, you know, you didn't do that great of a job. I felt a little repelled by it.
Do you remember what the repulsion was?
Oh, I don't think that she was terribly creative, for one thing. And I think she more or less had the urge to create. But the way she went at it, I mean, so this was, you know, early 1970s, and you know, teaching was more, I think, what word am I trying to grow up for? Like, more regimented, I guess.
Yeah, rule bound.
Yeah, that's a good word. Mm-hmm. And so, I just don't know. I don't feel like whatever I produced was terribly appreciated, and I don't think I was very appreciative of the efforts of the other students, because mm-hmm. we read each other's work, and I was like, this isn't how it would be at all. what were you thinking? I may have been the most talented child in the class, but I don't think I was maybe the nicest. So that was that. So anyway, that kind of turned me off of writing instruction, although I took some poetry classes in college, which were, you know, was to talk
well,
about.
Well, hold on a second. Because the other thing I'm hearing from you is all these other interests. You know, interest in the chemistry, interest in science, interest in what?
I played music.
Combat. Oh, you played music. What did you play?
I was interested in that. I started on the clarinet in elementary school, because there was a clarinet in the closet that my brother and sister had tried and put aside. So, I'll give it a try. And I was drawn to music as well quite a bit. And I played all the way through high school and was the best musician in the high school, and then got into, when I went to college, I played a little bit of clarinet, but I was really starting to gravitate more toward drums. When I was a younger child, well, girls don't play drums. You got to play, you know, the flute or something.
Right.
Anyway, but then I did get into drums. I fell into a bad crowd in college, and they all played drums, so I started playing drums too. To this day, I play, actually, as well. I play semi-professionally, actually, with a couple of ensembles.
Okay, so I want to back up. So clearly, it seems to me, although maybe I'm wrong, You're going through school, you have all these interests, but you have not said yet, or correct me if I'm wrong, I'm a writer or I want to be a writer. Do you know when that happened?
Well, you know, I think it was always kind of, for a very long time, was within me, you know.
Trying to get out?
You know, yeah, and I tried to kind of avoid it, I think, actually, because why? Because, you know, well, because the whole message for young writers then, and very much even now today, is, or young, old, any writers, is it's really hard. It's really hard to get something done well, and it's really hard, almost impossible, to get published and to get recognition and to earn a living. So you internalize these messages, especially when you're young, before you've figured out your own mind a little bit better and had better experience. And even when, you know, so when I finally, I mean, I worked as a journalist for a while. So
Hold on. You got ahead of yourself. And this is really interesting to me, because the same story would be true about musician. You know,
yes.
Right. And so, in an odd way, a lot of the things that you wanted to do had roadblocks. You know, the military or the police, that was not going to be all right. And, you know, and then the writing and the music, that was going to be really hard. So the stuff that you found, and you certainly, well, I don't know, maybe you thought about being a chemist, I don't know. But so it's not, there's no through line for you because of all this roadblockage. So what did you major in college?
I was one of those English majors that eventually it kind of worked out, as we see. So I didn't major in English because I really just, you know, it was the thing I took to the most. I loved to read. I loved to write. I did well. I got A's. I dabbled around in various things like that, various other, you know, I took electives and different things just to try other things out.
But you weren't thinking, I'm going to be a writer, so I'm going to major in English.
No, I didn't have that much direction, really. I didn't have that strong of an internal certainty.
I like to make that point because I think a lot of people think they need to know what they're doing, you know, the minute they come out of the womb, right? And if they don't, life is lost. I do like to make that point that you were sort of floating, you know, going where it looked like, right? Okay. Okay, so in college, English is not just writing, obviously. I mean, it's a lot about reading and, you know, things like scholarship and teaching and analyzing, all that stuff. So was there a point in college, or was it going to wait until you came out, that you thought, because you're playing music, you said, through college, right? And you're, you know, so was there a moment in college, or did it wait until you were out? Or
no, it was longer than that. But well, I mean, I knew I had a knack for writing, and I thought, well, somehow or other, I should be able to work around books, publishing, writing something or other, you know. So my first real job, as they say, out of college, was as a reporter and editor and photographer for a little tiny weekly newspaper near my town, in a couple towns over. This was in suburban Detroit. And that was, I only worked there for a couple of years, less than 3 years, but it was hugely important in adding to my education, both as learning how to write economically and edit. In fact, I edited piles of, you know, AP copy and other copy that would come in, the press releases and so forth. And it was also an education in how local governments really work, how they're supposed to, like, we're supposed to think they work, and then how they really work. You know, what really goes on, you know, who's stabbing who in the back behind the scenes and so forth. So that was a really good furtherment of my education. And then, you know, I did have the drive to write, and I would dabble around in little stories and poems and stuff like that and send things off. And I had a few poems published, you know, by little journals and stuff, but, you know, when I was just still in college, actually. I cast around different things. I did media for a bank in Michigan. I took a trip around the country and tried to figure things out, and I came back and, you know, looked around for other work. I did tech writing for a while, and then I decided, hell, I might as well just go back to college, get a PhD, get some job at some college someplace, and you know, be able to write on the side or whatever. I can teach and write, and at least I have something, and I think that's probably the best thing to do. So I went back.
Okay, wait, and again, I'm really interested in this.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
No, I'm going off in.
No. Everybody does. Everybody wants to tell their story the way they want to tell it, and I want to hear it the way I want to hear it.
And you're the boss. Here.
Okay. Yeah. Well, never mind. So again, this is like. This isn't, I have to do this. This makes the most sense for me.
Mm-hmm.
Given my skills and the fact that I have to make a living, this makes the most sense. So am I getting that accurately?
Yes, it was not this unquenchable drive.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know, like, I think that's really kind of what you're trying to differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, that's so. Yes, no, I
you were making the best choice.
Yes, that's
right.
What I thought.
So I guess you did. You went back to school and you got a PhD.
I went back to school, but I stopped after getting a master's. I was going to get my master's in, like, specializing in composition theory because I was in my research, I was like, well, profs there can get better jobs more easily than lit profs or creative writing MFA people. And so I got that master's and intended to go on for the PhD. However, two things happened. I began the master's program with the intention of going through to the PhD. But what happened, two things happened. One, I found that the academy was really not as open and welcoming of diverse ideas as I had thought, as I expected. I challenged a professor in class, who he described himself as a Marxist, Marxisto deconstructo guy, and that was kind of far out for me personally, and he spent a lot of time making fun of more conservative writers in class. And I challenged him once on that. And far from welcoming any discussion, he invited me to drop the class.
Oh.
That was, he sent me a letter saying, I think it would be best if you just drop the class, don't you? And I was like, seriously, dude?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I really wanted to graduate on time. I wanted to get through this. I needed that credit. I'm like, okay, look, I'll buckle down. You know, I'll buckle under. I won't, you know.
I'll pretend.
You know, yeah, I'll write my papers however you want me to write them, and I won't explore other avenues. So that was just like an example. And so at any rate, so the other thing that happened coincidentally to that was that I got a job at a little bookstore working for a couple of guys named Tom and Lewis Borders. Who you might remember who they were.
Yes.
They're still there, mm-hmm. so honorably. And they were just at the beginning of expanding their business. They had
their franchise.
Their initial store, the store that they had in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was a place that I would go to and enjoy. You know, I'd play hooky sometimes from work or something to go out there and enjoy and buy books. And then when I heard that they had opened a store nearby where I was living at the time, and I thought, well, I'll get a job there and be able to support myself while I'm going to college. I got a scholarship for going to school because I had no money, so they nicely gave me a free ride at Wayne State University in Detroit. And at the same time, so I'm working at this bookstore. Well, one thing leads to another, and suddenly I'm an assistant manager at this bookstore, and I realized that I have a talent for management. And then I became the general manager of that bookstore, and that was almost a $10 million a year business right there, that particular store in suburban Detroit and the northern suburbs. And then they said, well, you know, we really need you to kind of take the next step, and we need regional directors, and, you know, would you... And I'm like, yeah. So they moved me out to San Francisco to be the first regional director for the West Coast for the company. And I opened all of the initial Borders stores on from Los Angeles to Anchorage and out to Honolulu, all the way around the American West. So that was a heady time. And so that was when I realized that could be a pretty cool thing to do. And I really loved the company at that time. Very much loved working for the company. It was a great place to work. On the front lines, So I thought, well, I'll just put aside this PhD idea and see where this goes. So that's how that happened.
But then, yet again, you're just saying yes to whatever comes up, right? You're not directing your life particularly.
Well, I mean, I wanted to move along with the company once I realized that I liked it so well, and it was being around books.
Books,
you know?
Yeah.
However, at the same time, I was also dabbling around with my own writing and stories and a little novel and stuff. And I remember standing day after day behind the cash register selling books to people, and here's a bestseller that had come out, and I'm thinking, I could do this.
Yeah,
pushing it across the counter, I could do this, pushing it across the counter to the customer and taking their money. So eventually what happened was the Borders brothers sold the company, and then that new owner took it public, and things started to, the Philistines really kind of started to take over, and it was, I was one of the most unpopular women on the West Coast when we started to expand out there, because all the independent booksellers were terrified of us, and they were very enraged that we were coming along and opening these fabulous, really, stores in their neck of the woods. So I had to deal with all of that, and I was a spokesperson for the company and so forth, and was asked to debate, you know, on the radio, on panels and so forth. So I gained a bunch of different varying experience, and it was fun. And you know, you get a good job, you live in San Francisco, you know, it's a nice time of life. So that was going on. Anyway, I lost track. However, the company really started to change, and I became less and less happy with what I had to do, what I was expected to do, and with the changes that were affecting the frontline rank and file. And I just thought, you know, at the same time, now I know I really want to be a novelist. I really want this to do this. I think I can do it. I believe I now have the talent to make this work.
Can I ask how old mm-hmm. you were when you finally made that leap?
Late 30s, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yay.
I mean, you know, life's a journey, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I just keep wanting to make this point, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to know at 12 or 16 or 18 or 22. You don't know what you don't, you know.
No, indeed, no.
Right. Okay, so I'm assuming that you had a little cushion to fall back on, so
yeah.
you weren't going to be starving while you tried to follow this dream.
Yes, that's right. And I had a supportive partner at the time as well. And so I, you know, hammered out some work and shopped it around and didn't have a lot of luck. And okay, so this was the late 90s. And there was no internet publishing. There was no,
right.
You know, Amazon was barely getting going. And there was no Kindle self-publishing. There wasn't anything but the traditional route. So I, you know, searched for agents and editors and so forth. I eventually got tired of looking for an agent, and I approached a publisher myself and sold my first novel on my own to, at the time, the premier publisher in the LGBTQ genre called Allison Books in Los Angeles. They were based. So they started, really, I started my career with them, and then then after a while, I realized, and the following year, I mean, it didn't all happen all at once. You know, it took me some time, and I had a lot of no thank yous and a lot of no, and a few little nibbles here and there. But I knew that I had the talent. So that was at the point where I was at the point then where I knew that I had enough talent to somehow or other make this work.
And this is who I am.
That's what I'm hearing, right? Yeah,
yeah. I am now committed to this is who I am,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's yeah, like, I mean, you know, and I would think back to the day when I was, you know, 6 or 7 and came across, I was an early riser as a little child, and I would ghost around the house, you know, by myself, everybody else still sleeping, and I found this piece of paper with a poem typed on it that my mother had left around and lying around, and I looked at it and I thought, these words are so strange and funny and odd, and I kind of like them, and I kept reading it over and over again, and I thought it was really interesting, and one night at dinner somebody said something about something or other that made me start to say, 'twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, All mimsy were the Barrowgroves and the Mome Raths outgrave. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws. To this day, I can remember. I can recite the whole poem.
Are you saying you were six?
I was very young. Yes, six or seven. Seven? I don't know, something like that. Maybe eight.
It's amazing that you even could read it then, never mind memorize it.
Well, and the cool thing about this was I could just say these words, and they kind of had this rhythm to them, and they were kind of cool, you know.
Yeah, well, you were right. You were not the only person who fell for that poem, right? Right. So, oh, my God. So what did they do? Your family?
I don't remember, but I'm told. I don't even remember doing it, but I'm told that I did this. And I guess they all kind of dropped their forks for a while and just kind of looked at each other and, I don't know, you know, oh, whatever. Well, that's kind of unusual. I think that's all that they...
Yeah, but they must have... you must have, even though you don't remember it, you must have gotten the sense that this was a good thing you did, that this was remarkable or special
or something, right?
Yes.
My mother also remembered that we were camping with some, went camping with some other people who had small children. And I don't remember this. I was very small, but I'm told that around the campfire one night, everybody decided, well, let's each tell a story. And the other little kids, I guess, I'm told, bumbled around and, you know, whatever, did, made up some dumb shit. And so, but when it came to be my turn, I spun some fascinating yarn. I might have reiterated something my father had told me. I don't know. But so my mom always looks back on that and says, yeah, you know, you had a knack for storytelling back then.
Yeah, you were always a writer, right?
So,
but those things, they really do matter. They really do stay, whether you have conscious memory of them or not, right?
Yes, I'm sure you're right, of course.
You know, the idea of having gotten attention for it, being rewarded for it, even with smiles, right?
Yeah, there wouldn't have been much else, but yeah. You know.
Yes, right. Okay, so... So you get your first book published.
Yeah. So I started this little series about this little detective, she's not a detective, she's an amateur sleuth. She's a reporter who gets involved in solving a crime.
Oh, yeah, to that question. Did you choose mystery fiction? Or?
Oh, yeah, I did consciously choose that because I thought, well, you know, there's probably more money in that than, you know, literary fiction. You know, I mean, the people who write literary fiction... Excuse me, are the professors who have a nice job with health benefits and a paycheck.
right.
And they can afford to sit around and write beautiful, you know, fiction that takes them, you know, 2 years to write a novel or 10 or whatever.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. All many write things with that. I love beautifully done literary fiction. I hate pretentiously done literary fiction, but beautiful, honest work I will always enjoy. I thought that the kind of the crime thriller mystery genre would be the easier to, you know, either possibly break into, but also once broken into to be able to earn some money.
Yeah.
So when my second novel then came out, so
same,
the first
same
novel
publisher?
Was, yes, first novel, the title is Holy Hell, and I have reissued these under my own imprint. They're available on Amazon. But the second one was is called Damn Straight, and after that I ran out of
those
swear words to put in titles. That one won a Lambda Literary Award, which is the premier award in GLBTQ fiction. And I thought after that, well, I kept writing. I wrote another couple of books for that publisher, but I thought, you know, I would really like a bigger audience, so I think I'd like to write a book that has just only straight people in it, because my detective in the prior books, Lillian Bird, she identifies as a lesbian, and she has love affairs and so forth that go right and that go wrong usually for her. So I thought, well, I'm gonna kind of tap into my, you know, bisexuality here and write about a woman who is a stay-at-home, or not stay-at-home, a divorced single mom who, she winds up being an amateur sleuth, too. She's a struggling actress in Los Angeles, and she winds up using her acting skills to solve crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that became the actress, and then another couple in the series, the extra and On Location. So I did get, and in fact, I actually, before the actress, I wrote another book, another novel that I shopped around that got some attention. It got me my agent but did not get me that first hardcover contract. They took a look at it and said, we like this book a lot, we think you're a very good writer, but we don't think we can sell this one. What other ideas do you have? And so I had this idea about the actress and some other things. With like, that one about the actress, we think we can sell it if you write it. So that's what happened with that.
So that was the publishing company saying that, or the,
no,
that was the agent.
Right,
right,
right.
The
agency saying that, yeah. So that was, and they did sell it to a you know, hardcover publisher. The misfortune that I had was that it came out, so I was a debut hardcover author in the summer of 2008.
When no one has any money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so
right.
Sales were really,
yeah.
really tough to get,
yeah.
really tough to come by. Hardcover, you know, for a fairly unknown, I mean, basically an unknown author. So I wound up not having a mass market paperback come out with that book. I was still under contract for the other two, so I wrote the other two in the series. And they got into libraries across the country, but without a paperback, without a paperback series, it's really kind of rugged. So at that time then, you know, self-publishing was coming along and people were starting to do well in that. And I thought, well, maybe I'll see what I can do about these things too. And meanwhile, I was also beginning the other prong of my career, which was helping writers write better. I had some ideas for some writing prompts and things to help writers. And I approached a magazine called Writer's Digest, not Reader's Digest, Writer's Digest magazine, which is the premier writing magazine in the world, actually, I think. I'm sure they have the most circulation. And so they published that article that I had the idea for, and then one thing led to another, and I have been writing for them ever since, writing articles for them, and I became a contributing editor on the masthead some few years back. And so now... So now that's part of my thing is I go, I do workshops, I go to conferences and stuff here and there and share my knowledge about how to be a better writer and how to cut through the BS. So far the greatest achievement along those lines for me has been this book here that's on the table with us. You've Got a Book in You. This is an outgrowth of the whole thing. See, okay, when you're an author, a published author, people say, well, what do you do? Well, I'm an author. Well, you probably, yeah. Well, I'd like to be an author. I'd like to write a book too. You know, maybe you could help me. Is there something you could recommend? So I got tired of kind of brushing people off and saying, well, get a copy of the annual Writer's Market, which talks about publishers and agents. And I started reading. I wanted to be able to recommend a book on how to write well that was not full of bullshit and academic stuff, you know. And I looked, and I read the top ones, and there are some books out there that have value, of course, but they all of them, every one of them said, spent plenty of time saying, well, now you realize that the odds are so stacked against you. It's really hard to make it, and it's really hard to get anything really done, and it's really hard, and now the whole world is against you, and it's just almost impossible. So basically, forget it. But here's my advice on how to do it. And I'm like, screw that. You know, I can't. This is terrible. This is just terrible. I can't recommend these books. I mean, these are books that are very much more famous than mine, but they're famous in my opinion, less deservedly. At any rate, so I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to write my own book that's about how it's actually easy to write if you get out of your own way and let your natural talent and creativity take over. That's my message, and that because that's been my experience. I wouldn't have been able to write 4, 5, 6, 7, now 9 novels. 10 if you count in a couple unpublished ones, 11. Had I not figured out a way to make it not horribly difficult, I figured out a way to make it easy. And again, it has so much to do with tuning into one's own inner self and shutting up that little horrible little, you know, I call it the little bitch or bastard on your shoulder, you know, the little bad voice that says, oh, that's no good, or, oh, that, well, oh, what do you think, oh, that, no, that's, no, that sucks, no, throw that away, that's terrible. You gotta shut that little person up. and listen to something much more deep and good.
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay. So you wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then, if I have this correctly, what's happened now is that you are still writing. You're still writing fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you're writing for the Writer's Digest,
mm-hmm.
and you are a mobile writing teacher.
Yeah, sort of. Yes, itinerant.
Right, itinerant. Yes, that's right. Yeah, right. You take your little ideas, and you go on the road. Right, and that now you're about to teach creative writing at the Ringling School of Art and Design.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to start in the new semester.
Yes.
Okay, so if you go to Ringling. And you're interested in writing, you should think about signing up for Elizabeth's course, right?
If it weren't already full,
Oh, sorry. Well, then you want to get on the list, right?
Next time, yeah. I don't know how much teaching I will do there. I mean, as famously true, adjuncts are kind of the bottom of the pecking order in terms of professordom. But I wanted and you certainly are not going to ever get very rich doing it.
Mm.
But I wanted to do it for the credential, and B, for the experience of putting together a course for young people. I haven't worked with young people in a while. I mean, I taught a little bit here and there when I was a student myself, a grad student. You know, you do a little of that, but. More of my experience has been much more practical and not laden with the rules of the academy. So I'm going to try to make this course as freewheeling as possible, and we'll see how that works.
Yes, right.
But yeah, so it should be. I mean, it's kind of insane. It should be interesting. We will see. Maybe I'll be moved to continue teaching there at Ringling or not. We'll see.
Well, the two things that occurred to me are, this is what you started out trying to do.
Yes.
And the other is that if you study with Elizabeth, you will not have rigidity.
That is a fact, my lady. That is a fact. You know, yeah. I mean, there are such things as standards. There is quality, and there is lack of quality. And, of course, the debate as to what quality is never ending, really, but beyond what I'm, yeah, my aim. Oh, another thing I actually do also on the side is I help authors, private clients who want me to look at their book and do a developmental line edit for them, and I do these things. I work with private clients, but I'm not taking anybody new at this time, so I just don't have the time. I am working with a few older clients, so that's been another like mini income stream that has helped me over time. It really is. It's just something that you just got to always keep on working on. I'm hoping that anyone I work with, whether it will be a student at this college or one of my private clients or anyone who reads my material about writing well, my greatest hope is that they apprehend, they improve. I mean, that's one way to put it, that they understand, that they start to be able to differentiate between weak material and strong material, between writing that is simple and workmanlike, but that also sings. Simple and workmanlike can be boring as hell, but it can also be sublime. And these are now, you know, we get into the more almost spiritual or, as I said before, metaphysical aspects of the art, and that's what I'm about in my own writing. It's what nourishes me when I set down, when I set pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, and this is the joy and the commitment to improvement, commitment to quality, a commitment to something beyond the commercial that I wish to help everyone find.
It's lovely. It's very lovely. Did you ever read The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Oh, one of my favorite books.
Yeah, right. Yes. Talk about quality.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's right.
Robert M. Persig, the author of that, right. I've probably read that 10 times at least.
Yeah, I only read it once, but boy, it stayed with me. And the whole idea that there is such a thing as quality, that was so powerful for me.
Yes, and that it's okay to talk about it. And
to look for it, to work for it, to believe in it. Right, exactly, exactly, right. Okay, so my last question is, usually I ask, because so many of the people that I interview, writers or dancers or singers or, you know, painters, they've been doing it really since they were born. You know, they come in and they've spent a life, or it takes them, you know, through elementary school, they discover it or something like that. So I'm able to ask them, having spent a life doing this thing, what does it feel like? But you haven't, and that's really interesting to me. So I wonder if I could phrase it this way. What would you say about the experience of your early life where you weren't exactly sure, and then the difference when you have found yourself?
Yeah, well, there's a certain relief, I think, you know, and a certain, you know, part of it all is simply also moving through life as a human and knowing that there are seasons of life, you know, there are, you are young and then you are old, hopefully, if you're lucky, you get old before you die, but, and in between, there are passages, there are, certain dreams and goals. You achieve certain ones, you realize, no, that's probably not going to ever happen, you know, and some, like, I really wanted to do that when I was, no, screw that. I have different ideas now. So part of it is all about, you know, the passage of life and one's personal journey that is even more, it's about more than even one's outward journey, you know, but one's inner journey. That's another whole big aspect of things. Ideally, there's a meshing in there, and I think that's what I'm getting to is that has happened for me. Mm-hmm. You know, when I get the such great joy and pleasure out of producing what I consider to be good work, and what at least some others consider it also to be good work. Fun, entertaining. I mean, part of also what I learned, and this is something that you'll hardly ever get in school, is, or at some of these, you know, literary magazine offices, my God, is one must take one's art seriously. But if you take yourself as seriously as you take your art, you're going to be insufferable. And I don't take myself as seriously as I take my art. My art, I do comedy in my art. My fiction mostly is kind of a deadpan comic noir, is how I might describe it. And it's subtle humor, and a lot of people don't get it. but the ones that do are my people. So. Anyway, but I'm very serious about doing a good job with that. And sometimes. Comedy of any kind, will, you know, gets discounted because it's not thought to be serious.
Serious.
You know, I mean, comedies rarely win an Academy Award, for instance, in the film business, let's say. It's just how it is. But yet, there is something wonderful about putting something together, about putting a little irony in there, about putting a little bit of, you know, discord in there that... That I really enjoy as both as a consumer of any kind of entertainment or art and as a producer of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Sims.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Lynn, for having me.
So, she gets joy and pleasure from producing what she considers to be good work. You can hear in everything that Elizabeth says about her work, about what she does. You can hear when she talks about the joy and pleasure that she gets from her writing. You can hear it. You can hear the delight, the satisfaction, the contentment. Because this is a woman who has found who she is and what she wants to do with her life. I play interviews with people like Elizabeth, in the hopes that when you listen to them, you're asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Am I getting joy and pleasure over what I'm doing and how I'm spending my days, spending my life? Well, if you are one of the many who had an experience in your childhood which convinced you that something about you was not okay, and so you had to put it aside, pretend it wasn't true, and finally achieve denial about it? If there is something that you've always wanted to do but was never quite able to allow yourself that gift, and you want to talk to me about it, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. There you can click on the email tab and ask me any questions you like. I'll be glad to answer them. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do, and What to Do About It. Well, as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, something that made you curious about whether you are the whole person that you are, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So